Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. New York, this is Democracy Now!
The thing to understand about Musk is that he operates on that internet-style, fluid, improvisational way of doing things. He's like a live streamer who's busted into a nuclear missile silo, and in the chat is every weirdo from the Heritage Foundation, the America First Institute, every groiper, and they're just in the chat going like, press that button, break that, see what happens. It can feel like he's just buffeting us with chaos, but once you understand what's going on, it makes a lot more sense.
As 21 staffers at Doge resign in protest over Elon Musk's moves to jeopardize the sensitive data of millions of Americans and dismantle much of the federal government, we'll speak to Cory Doctorow, the science fiction writer, activist, and prominent critic of big tech. Then to the anti-death penalty crusader, Sister Helen Prejean.
I am overjoyed at the news that the Supreme Court of the United States overturned Richard Glossop's death sentence and declared that he needs to have a new trial. Lies were told at his trial and prosecution allowed it. It's all exposed, and so this man has a chance for freedom.
And finally, the National Guard's been called into prisons here in New York as prison guards continue a wildcat strike at Attica and other prisons. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Federal courts have ordered a pause to much of President Trump's agenda in a trio of rulings involving refugees, federal spending, and foreign aid. In the first ruling on Tuesday, U.S. District Judge Lauren Ali Khan in Washington, D.C., ordered the White House to pause its spending freeze on grants, loans, and other financial aid. In a second ruling, U.S. District Judge Jamal Whitehead in Seattle blocked Trump's executive order suspending refugee admissions and funding. And in a third case, U.S. District Judge Amir Ali in Washington, D.C., ordered the Trump administration to comply with his order from 2 weeks ago to unfreeze billions of dollars for foreign assistance grants and contracts. U.S. federal workers face fresh uncertainty after billionaire Elon Musk gave them a second chance to respond to his order that they justify their jobs or risk termination. Musk's latest directive came in a post on his social media site X late Monday. It contradicted guidance from the Office of Personnel Management, telling workers they could ignore Musk's earlier email ordering them to summarize their accomplishments or risk losing their jobs. On Tuesday, Trump added to the chaos and uncertainty with these comments.
Well, it's somewhat voluntary, but it's also, if you don't answer, I guess you get fired.
On Tuesday, Doge quietly dropped false claims from its website about what it called its five biggest savings to U.S. taxpayers. The reversals included Doge's claim of $8 billion in cuts at Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The figure was, in fact, $8 million. Elon Musk will join President Trump's first cabinet meeting scheduled for today, even though Musk was not confirmed by the Senate to a cabinet post and is listed by the White House as a special government employee. The White House said Tuesday Musk is not the head of Doge, the Department of Government Efficiency. Instead, the White House said Doge's interim administrator is Amy Gleason, who's worked at the U.S. Digital Service during Trump's first term before Musk rebranded it. The New York Times reports Gleason is on vacation in Mexico, was not aware the White House plan to make her role public now. Meanwhile, 21 Doge staffers have quit in protest of Musk's actions, writing in a joint resignation letter, quote, "We will not use our skills as technologists to compromise core government systems, jeopardize Americans' sensitive data, or dismantle critical public services," they wrote. The Republican-led House of Representatives has narrowly approved a budget framework for much of President Trump's agenda, proposing $4.5 $1 trillion in tax cuts and a $2 trillion reduction in federal spending over the next decade. Among other provisions, the budget would likely slash about $800 billion over a decade from Medicaid, threatening health care coverage to more than 72 million people. All 215 House Democrats voted against the budget. On Tuesday, the Congressional Progressive Caucus launched a campaign for an alternative budget, the, quote, Tax the Greedy Billionaires Coalition. Ukrainian officials say at least seven people were killed overnight as Russia launched a wave of deadly drone strikes on the capital Kyiv and parts of eastern Ukraine. Separately, Russia said it shot down scores of Ukrainian drones launched into the Russian annexed region of Crimea. The fighting came as the White House hinted Ukraine is prepared to sign a deal granting the U.S. access to Ukrainian resources, including oil, gas and rare earth minerals. Trump said Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will visit the White House Friday to sign the agreement. Meanwhile, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says a delegation of U.S. diplomats will meet with their Russian counterparts in Istanbul Thursday to restore diplomatic ties after the U.S. and Russia withdrew embassy staff at the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine 3 years ago. Israel and Hamas have reached a deal on the release of 620 Palestinian prisoners, including women and children, imprisoned by Israel in exchange for the bodies of four Israeli hostages who died in Gaza. The swap will take place Thursday after Israel delayed the release of hundreds of Palestinians in a move Hamas officials said was another attempt to sabotage the Gaza ceasefire. This comes as the United Nations is urging Israel to allow mobile homes and shelters into Gaza after six Palestinian infants died from hypothermia due to the freezing cold. Meanwhile, school children have joyfully returned to school in Gaza for the first time since October 2023.
After an absence of about a year and a half, we returned to school. The feeling is indescribable. Honestly, it's a unique and special feeling. However, there's a slight flaw. It's not really a school. First of all, the walls are destroyed. There are no benches, no blackboards. We even brought our prayer mats with us to sit on. And they were barely enough. There are no teaching materials available to help us study. Despite all of this, we overcame this conditions.
Nearly all of Gaza's schools have been destroyed by Israel. In Syria, at least two people are dead after Israel's military launched air raids on the capital and parts of southern Syria. On Tuesday, low-flying Israeli warplanes rattled residents of Damascus before dropping bombs on the nearby town of Kiswe. Separately, Israel bombed sites in the southern province of Daraa. Israel's military later said it had struck military command centers and multiple sites containing weapons. The attacks came just hours after Syria's transitional government demanded Israel withdraw from Syrian territory it's occupied since rebels ousted Bashar al-Assad in December. International Criminal Court prosecutor Karim Khan arrived in the Democratic Republic of Congo Tuesday in a push to end violence that's seen Rwanda-backed M23 soldiers overrun cities in the eastern DRC, killing more than 7,000 people while displacing hundreds of thousands. Speaking to reporters in the capital, Kinshasa, Karim Khan laid out his goals for the visit.
To try to make sure there is a consistent, there is a comprehensive, there is a sustainable and holistic approach to justice that draws the poison of criminality away from the soil and allows the people and your children to march forward to, God willing, a brighter future after these very dark days that you're going through right now.
On Tuesday, the United Kingdom announced a pause on some bilateral aid to Rwanda and other diplomatic sanctions over Kigali's role in supporting M23. The Trump administration's announced a new visa ban targeting Cuban officials who are tied to a decades-old program that primarily sends Cuban doctors and healthcare workers to assist other countries. Secretary of State Marco Rubio erroneously described the program as forced labor. Cuba began deploying doctors around the world after the 1959 Cuban Revolution to disaster sites and during disease outbreaks, such as the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic and during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Cuba's foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez, slammed the restrictions as part of Rubio's, quote, personal agenda, unquote. Rubio is the son of Cuban immigrants, has been persistently advocating for harsher sanctions on Cuba despite the catastrophic impacts. The White House has announced plans to handpick the pool reporters who will be allowed to ask President Trump questions, breaking from decades of precedent that saw the White House Correspondents Association determine which journalists have close access to the president. Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt announced the changes on Tuesday.
A select group of D.C.-based journalists should no longer have a monopoly over the privilege of press access at the White House. All journalists, outlets, and voices deserve a seat at this highly coveted table. So by deciding which outlets make up the limited press pool on a day-to-day basis, the White House will be restoring power back to the American people.
The White House Correspondents Association condemned the changes, writing, quote, "This move tears at the independence of a free press in the United States. It suggests the government will choose the journalists who cover the president. In a free country, leaders must not be able to choose their own press corps," unquote. On Monday, a federal judge denied a request from the Associated Press for a temporary restraining order after the Trump administration cut off AP's access to cover major events at the White House unless it agrees to follow Trump's order that it refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. The Trump administration's moving forward with plans to force millions of undocumented people to register with the federal government or face criminal prosecution. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem threatened undocumented immigrants with being hunted down and deported if they fail to register, fulfilling another one of Trump's executive orders signed on his first day in office. This comes as a group of elite military contractors, including former CEO and founder of the for-profit mercenary company Blackwater, Eric Prince, has offered to set up so-called processing camps on military bases and deploying an army of private citizens to arrest immigrants. The blueprint has an estimated cost of $25 billion and would certainly face legal and operational challenges. Prince is the brother of former Trump Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. In Tennessee, Republican lawmakers have introduced a bill that would prohibit undocumented immigrants from pursuing most lawsuits, such as suing for medical malpractice. This is Nashville civil rights attorney Chris Smith.
It deprives undocumented immigrants of the right to bring a declaratory judgment action. That's the vehicle under Tennessee law where you can challenge the constitutionality of a statute. So by saying you can't even file lawsuits to challenge the constitutionality, it's a complete stripping of rights of undocumented people.
The U.S. Supreme Court has ordered a new trial for Richard Glossop, who's been in Oklahoma's death row for nearly three decades. Glossop has for years maintained his innocence after being convicted as the mastermind behind the 1997 murder for hire of his former employer. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast with Glossop's spiritual advisor, anti-death penalty activist, Sister Helen Prejean. In a victory for labor rights, the food delivery app DoorDash has been ordered to pay nearly $17 million for secretly using customer tips to subsidize the wages of its delivery workers here in New York, instead of allowing them to keep their tips on top of their guaranteed wages. The payout will go toward thousands of DoorDash workers, most of whom are immigrants, who made deliveries between May 2017 and September 2019. In a statement, Gustavo Arche, a leader with the group Los Deliveristas Unidos, said on X, quote, "I am proud of our fight, and recovering this money that belongs to the workers is a great victory. Personally, I'm always grateful to the thousands of New Yorkers for their generosity, but we're always on the sidelines of someone who wants to take advantage of us. But we are here to fight for justice and dignity, si se puede," he said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
President Trump's holding his first cabinet meeting today. The White House has confirmed attendees will include Elon Musk, the world's richest man, who's expected to talk about DOGE, the so-called Department of Government Efficiency, which is working to dismantle the entire U.S. government agencies and reduce government services. Earlier this week, 21 staffers at DOGE resigned in protest over Musk's actions. In a joint resignation letter, the engineers, data scientists, designers, and product managers wrote, quote, "We will not use our skills as technologists to compromise core government systems, jeopardize American sensitive data, or dismantle critical public services. We will not lend our expertise to carry out or legitimize DOGE's actions," they wrote. The mass resignation comes amidst growing questions over the legality and effectiveness of DOGE's actions. Last week, DOGE claimed it had saved taxpayers $8 billion by canceling a single immigration-related contract. In fact, it wasn't $8 billion. The contract was $8 million. DOGE has since removed reference to this and four other large contracts that it highlighted on its so-called wall of receipts, removing all top five. While Musk is attending today's cabinet meeting, the White House claims it's claiming the actual head of DOGE is a little-known government employee named Amy Gleason, currently on vacation in Mexico. She reportedly was not aware the White House was planning to reveal her name. Meanwhile, Musk has given a new ultimatum to federal workers to justify their jobs or risk being fired, this despite pushback from several agency heads. As Elon Musk tries to reshape the federal government, much like he did after taking over Twitter, we're joined by a prominent critic of big tech, Cory Doctorow. He's a science fiction author, activist, and journalist. He works for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He has a new book out. It's called Picks and Shovels, a Martin Hench novel. Cory, it's great to have you with us at the table here in New York. Why don't you start off by responding to what Elon Musk is doing? He'll be apparently at this cabinet meeting, though he's not a cabinet member approved by the Senate today, with President Trump. When did you first come to know Elon Musk? And tell us a story.
Oh, it's a funny story. So I'm a science fiction writer. I write, broadly speaking, cyberpunk novels. I've also been involved in digital rights for about 25 years. And one day Elon Musk tweeted that he considered himself a utopian socialist in the model of E&M Banks. Now, I knew Banks a little. He was a friend and a friendly colleague of mine, a socialist science fiction writer from Scotland. And I said, I knew Ian. He was an ardent trade unionist. You're under innumerable investigations by the NLRB. I don't think you can call yourself a utopian socialist in his model and his mode. And Musk replied,
"Remember, no curses."
Yeah, indeed. Musk replied, "Well, I've read his classic culture novel series, and there are no trade unions there." And I said, "Yes, but it takes place in a far future where you have giant spaceships with a trillion people on them traveling at 1,000 times the speed of light, controlled by artificial intelligences with many millions of times the capacity of human beings." And he said, "Well, I have very advanced factories to make my Teslas." And I said, "There is an enormous difference between the world imagined by Ian Banks and the process of eking out very tiny gains in the efficiency of making electric vehicles." And he called me an enemy of humanity and blocked me. So that was my only experience with him. But, you know, like innumerable tech bros, he has mistaken cyberpunk for a suggestion rather than a warning. As someone who is in the business of writing a lot of warnings, I find this baffling and indeed very demoralizing.
And Cory, you also work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is tries to defend freedom and technology, law and policy. Well, how do you respond to Musk's claim that he believes in free speech absolutism?
Well, I'm very proud to have worked with the EFF for 23 years. We are the first organization to have filed a lawsuit that names Musk and DOGE by name. We're suing over the Privacy Act for the privacy of Americans and federal workers. You know, this idea that Musk is the apotheosis of a kind of tech ethic it's easy to fall into if all you pay attention to are tech bosses and the odd, you know, broccoli hair brown shirt that they send into our federal agencies. But when you look at what tech workers have historically done, you find a cohort of people who, by and large, got interested in tech because they themselves experienced something profound and liberatory by connecting to networks that connected them to people all over the world and to, you know, disfavor political views like the idea that Black Lives Matter or women shouldn't be routinely sexually harassed by their bosses. All of these things that have come to the fore thanks to the ability of people to organize over tech. And they want to bring that liberatory power to other people. And often they've been able to hold the line against their bosses, even as their bosses opted for this very callow, you know, rent-seeking approach to things, because tech workers were in such high demand. They weren't unionized, but they had a lot of power that arose from their scarcity. The fact that you could walk across the street from any big tech shop and get another job the same day that paid just as well, if not better, as the job you were in, meant that tech workers often told their bosses to go to hell when their bosses told them to screw up the things that they'd missed their mother's funerals to ship on time. And so even as we saw the dismantling of other forces that disciplined tech companies, the dismantling of antitrust law that allowed these companies to buy all their competitors, merge to monopoly, and reduce the internet to five giant websites filled with screenshots of text from the other four, the regulatory capture that sees grotesqueries like Keir Starmer firing their top tech trustbuster and replacing him last month with the former head of Amazon UK. As we saw the expansion of IP law that made it illegal to jailbreak devices and add ad blockers and privacy blockers and do other things that allow, say, gig workers to refuse to take jobs unless the wage rose to a threshold that all the gig workers in a region agreed was sufficient for a living wage. Even as those forces melted away, you saw tech workers holding the line against their bosses. And I think this is one of the reasons that tech bosses are so horny about AI. If you listen to the rhetoric carefully, you'll hear that what they really are excited about is not just the idea of generically replacing labor with AI, but specifically replacing coders with AI. And if you talk to experienced coders about what it's like to co-pilot your programming session with AI, very experienced coders say, oh, well, I can get a little bit of efficiency gains around the edges. But the idea that you replace all those very experienced coders and replace them with low-level coders without much experience who just supervise the AI is a recipe for producing tech debt at scale, where you have lurking bugs that eventually come back to bite you in the butt. But for tech bosses, firing this uppity workforce, adding to the 250,000 that they fired in 2023, the 150,000 they fired in 2024, the tens of thousands they fired this year, the ones that Facebook has just announced they're going to fire with a 5% across-the-board wage cut that's coupled with double bonuses for their executives this year. You know, this is the thing that excites them, is the ability to get rid of the last group of people who, like these tech workers who just resigned from the U.S. government, have said, I will not allow my boss to harm my users.
I wanted to ask you a speech you gave in Toronto on Monday evening. You talked about the Trump presidency as an existential crisis, but also one that presents opportunities. What kind of opportunities?
Yeah, sure. You know, when life gives you SARS, you got to make sarsaparilla. And if you look at the worst tech policies around the world, they came at the end of a coercive process delivered by the U.S. trade representative, who said that if you want free trade with the U.S., if you don't have to pay tariffs when your goods are exported to the U.S., you are going to have to agree that it's illegal to reverse engineer and modify U.S. tech products, which means that you can't modify the digital diagnostic system in a car so that any mechanic can fix it without buying $10,000 per vendor tools from the official vendors. It means that if you want to refill printer ink cartridges so that you can make your own generic ink in country rather than paying the American firms like HP the incredible premiums they charge on ink. I mean, I know ink is not our biggest issue here, but ink cost $10,000 a gallon. It's the most expensive fluid you as a civilian can purchase without a permit. Ink is so expensive that now you print your grocery lists with colored water that costs more per milliliter than the semen of a Kentucky Derby winning stallion. And the only reason that Canada, Mexico, European countries in the global south can't refill their ink cartridges is reverse engineering the lock on the ink cartridge is illegal. Now, if the only reason we have these laws is because these countries have pursued a
tariff-free relationship with the U.S. And if Trump is engaged in this like unscheduled mid-air disassembly of the global trade system, and now we have Canadians faced with 25% across-the-board tariffs to ship their goods to the U.S., why bother keeping these laws on the books? And if they do remove these laws, if we do allow domestic tech competitors all over the world to reverse engineer, modify, and erode the high monopoly rents extracted by these American tech firms, we do something very effective in this trade war, because the only thing keeping the S&P 500 afloat are these tech monopolists. If you take the big tech stocks out of the S&P 500, you've got a stock market that has been in decline for a decade. And when you look, decompose their balance sheets and you see where they get all their money, it's from price gouging on repairs, service, parts, consumables, software. You know, every time a Canadian software author writes an app and a Canadian customer buys that app, 30 cents of every dollar that Canadian customer spends makes a round trip through Cupertino, California, where Apple takes 30 cents out of it. We could just abolish that system and create a 30% premium for every newspaper that collects subscription dollars through an app, every software author, every musician, every book author, every music or games creator who runs through these big U.S. app stores. And if you did this, you would kick American big industry right in the dongle. You know, if you're angry at Elon Musk, you know, don't just get performatively offended about his Nazi salutes. Make it legal for mechanics all over the world to jailbreak Teslas so that every subscription feature in that Tesla that generates the recurring revenue source that creates Tesla's ridiculous earnings to valuation ratio, all of those car owners can just for one price get all that service unlocked. Elon Musk never gets another dime from them. That really hits him where it hurts. He loves the attention that he gets from the Nazi salute. He's going to be a lot less happy if he can't get, you know, a couple $100 every month from every Tesla owner for access to the full battery or the acceleration curve or any of the other things that he sells as a subscription in his cars.
Elon Musk recently appeared on Fox News, as usual, alongside President Trump, defending his actions at Doge.
One of the biggest functions of the Doge team is just making sure that the presidential executive orders are actually carried out. And this is, I just want to point out, this is a very important thing, because the president is the elected representative of the people. So he's representing the will of the people. And if the bureaucracy is fighting the will of the people and preventing the president from implementing what the people want, then what we live in is a bureaucracy and not a democracy.
So that's what some of what Elon Musk said. But I also want to follow up with what just happened at HUD, Housing and Urban Development, the agency. All the workers were ordered back. Washington Post reporting that the Trump administration plans to slash what half of the workforce of HUD. Current and former employees said the cuts are likely to upend housing markets, make homes less affordable, royal mortgage transactions. On Monday, when workers return to work, the screens all over HUD on all the floors at HUD headquarters were apparently hacked to show a looped AI-generated video portraying, and we're going to show this, President Trump kissing the feet of Elon Musk. The video was labeled in big white letters, "Long live the real king." Even as a science fiction writer, Cory Doctorow, could you have imagined anything more strange than this reality we're living in right now?
Well, I, as a science fiction writer, I especially appreciate the fact that Elon Musk has two left feet in that AI-generated image. You could not ask for a stupider timeline than the one in which you get these AI gonks in your weird propaganda videos. Look, this is a funny spectacle. It's very interesting to see, and I'm sure this gave heart to a lot of demoralized HUD workers. And the point of this chaotic blitz is to demoralize their opponents, right? In the reality-based world, even if you are worried about government waste, even if you want to make the government smaller, you have to acknowledge the empirical fact that payroll accounts for 4% of the federal budget. If Elon Musk manages to cut 50% of the federal workforce, a move that would leave us without functional roads or aviation or any of these other things that you kind of need if you're going to make money out of the economy, he would cut 2% of the federal budget. You know, you can find a couple trillion dollars in government waste. All you have to do is look for Beltway bandits who are marking up their services to the U.S. government by triple-digit margins. Unfortunately, those aren't the people that they're pursuing.
And Corey, I wanted to ask you about Luigi Mangione, the 26-year-old suspect or charged with the shooting death of United Healthcare CEO Brian Thompson. This is eerily reminiscent of one of your novels, Radicalized, in 2018. Could you talk about that novel and also how this issue personally relates to your own life?
And Juan, Corey's having a little trouble hearing you, but he's asking about Luigi Mangione. And if you can relate it to you, what happened there with also your own experience.
Yeah, sure. So I'm going to have to out myself here. I'm a Canadian, like all the best Americans. We're everywhere. We're just like serial killers. We look just like everyone else. And in 2019, I published this book called Radicalized. And there's a novella in it, this title novella, Radicalized, which was a rumination on my experience as a Canadian moving to the United States and for the first time encountering this gun culture firsthand and being somewhat